This podcast is brought to you in part by Bangor Savings Bank. Bangor Savings Bank celebrates local every day. It's where we live, work, and play. Bangor Savings knows local is a little bit different for everyone. It's the region, the people, the businesses, and the sense of community that makes your local so unique. And Bangor Savings Bank supports your local by partnering with people and communities in support of that wonderfully local way of life. It's what Bangor Savings Bank has been doing since 1852, investing in you, your business, and your community to help New England thrive. Bangor Savings Bank, where you and your local matter more. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
So you remember in the last episode, we talked about how the tribes of Maine, especially the Penobscot and the Passamaquoddy, gave up some of their sovereign power. I really wanted to talk to someone who was actually there for the negotiations in 1980. Everyone said, you should talk to Wayne. Some even offered to take me to Wayne's wigwam. I had no idea what a wigwam was, but we arrived and it was a red house in a suburban-looking neighborhood in Indian Township, Maine.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
And you found me.
We did find you. We had
Wayne Newell is a stout man with his pants pulled halfway up his belly, secured by suspenders. He's hooked up to an oxygen tank with a tube that's at least 50 feet long to let him get around the house. He hustles us past the kitchen when, to my horror, I saw the oxygen line was about to get caught on the leg of his recliner.
Hang on. You're stuck.
There we go.
Wayne was unfazed. He was on the move. Wayne is 79 years old, but back when he was in his 30s, he was invited to represent the Passamaquoddy in Washington, D.C., as they started talks about changing the relationship between the tribes and the state of Maine.
I was a member of that negotiating team, and we negotiated in that Roosevelt room. And I said to myself, God, they must regard this as really important.
These talks were taking place between the federal government, the state of Maine, and the two big tribes, the Penobscot and the Passamaquoddy. It would eventually result in the Maine Indian Claims Settlement Act. Wayne thought it was a pretty good deal at the time, but over the next 40 years, tribal members would end up blaming the deal for just about everything that's wrong on the reservation.
I started hearing more and more from the younger people. There was a blanket condemnation of the negotiating committee. And the young people are right. We already had sovereignty. Why did you give it away? Which is a legitimate point of view.
And that's my question.
Yeah.
Did you know you were giving it away?
I'm not sure I knew.
From the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies, this is Sovereign, a podcast about the fight for tribal autonomy in Maine. I'm Sanam Skelly. For around 100 years in this country, Native tribes have been considered nations within a nation. But in Maine, the situation is way more complicated. Maine has restricted the rights of the tribes within its borders more than any other state. And here's the kicker. The tribes, they signed off on this agreement. In this episode of Sovereign, we ask why. After centuries of Native tribes in Maine historically getting screwed by bad deals and broken promises, subjected to racism and violence, why would these tribes give up a legitimate claim to their land? Especially when you consider that the tribes leading up to 1980 were winning big, huge. They were finally getting everything they ever wanted.
Now a message from our sponsor, Bangor Savings Bank. Bangor Savings Bank celebrates New England's local way of life every day. It's where we live, work, and play. With the personal service and heart of a local bank and the resources and technology of a much larger bank, Bangor Savings Bank works hard to fill the needs of your local community. Bangor Savings Bank, where you and your local matter more. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. Now back to the show.
Every time I asked anybody in Maine about what happened with the 1980 Settlement Act, they say, to understand that, you have to go back 200 years, 400 years. Or when I asked tribal historian Donald Soktoma,
to know why that year is significant, you have to go back into time. The history book said Native Americans have been in North America for 3,000 years. We find archaeological sites 13,000 years old.
Unfortunately, I only have about 15 minutes to tell this story, so here's my hot take on the tribal history of Maine. Tribes are living in peace, hunting, fishing, living off the land for a good 13,000 years. Then the Europeans show up and they are brutal. Straight up genocide. Tribes are ravaged by disease and torn apart by war, so they start making deals to survive. Deals that we affectionately refer to as treaties. The story in Maine is a little different from that of other tribes. They go way back, all the way back to good old GW. That's right. George Washington made nice with the tribes because he needed their help in fighting in the American Revolutionary War. They fought together. In exchange, GW promised the tribes that they would be taken care of. The war was won. The promises fell by the wayside. Down the line, there would be another treaty, formalized as an offer of a trust fund, land, and islands. And in 1820, when Maine became a state, the promises of that treaty were written into their constitution. And everything from that point forward was great, and Maine upheld their end of the bargain. Psych! None of that happened. Maine plunders the trust fund, sells off most of the land, and this isn't just happening in the 1800s. It's happening all the way into the 1960s. Maine had effectively turned the tribes into wards of the state. They don't have the right to vote, and they can't find work. Wayne Newell, the guy we met at the beginning of the episode, he remembers how things were. They had this thing, someone officially called an Indian agent, who had to approve every purchase they made. To be clear, the Indian agent was not a native. He was a white dude assigned by the state to manage tribal affairs.
Tell me exactly how that works.
My mother usually did that. She would call up and say, you know, we really need a grocery order, and the Indian agent would say yes or no, and that's how you did it.
So they would refuse people food?
Basically, yeah.
And what would your mother then do if she was told no?
Well, whatever there was, you know, a lot of our diet was like potatoes, and if it was a Sunday, you'd probably have some bologna, and that was festive.
The tribal members in Maine were among the poorest people in America. They had been promised so much, and so much had been taken.
We were forgotten.
Until one day, those forgotten promises were remembered. That old treaty with the land and the trust fund, it was found, tucked away in a trunk in an old house on the reservation at Indian Township, far east in Maine. And the discovery of that treaty started this domino effect of legal action.
My name is Tom Tureen. I was lead counsel in the Maine Indian Land Claims.
Tom Tureen was responsible for initiating the explosive claim that rocked the state of Maine. As the 70s rolled around, it was no secret that tribes had been shortchanged by bad deals, including the hidden treaty I told you about. Tribes gave up their vast ancestral territory for a bit of money and some land nobody else wanted. Basically, Maine pushed them as far east as they could go. They came close to being Canadian. But Tom Tureen discovered a rarely used federal law passed in 1790 that said no tribal lands could be sold without congressional approval.
It had been on the books for 180 years. Nobody had ever acted as though it applied to these tribes. And a court could have gone either way.
What Tom's old federal law said was, all those bad deals,
nobody had a right to make those deals in the first place. Congress didn't approve any of it. So what does this mean? It means, essentially, every sale of tribal land for the last 200 years was null and void. It was a long shot, but if Tom could get a judge to agree, tribal members should still own 2/3 of Maine, the state. 2/3, millions of acres of land. So, based on some technicalities, Tom gets the U.S. government to sue Maine on behalf of the tribes. At stake, most of the land in Maine. The land claim seemed so ridiculous that nobody paid it any attention for the first few years, least of all Maine. Nobody in their right mind was going to entertain the idea of returning that amount of land back to native tribes. Until a judge said, you know what? That old federal law seems legit. And if the judge thought the federal law was legit, it also raised the question, who the hell owns Maine? Suffice it to say, Tom Tureen and the tribes now had Maine's attention.
It was an enormous problem and one that couldn't wait. So they were forced to the negotiating table.
Think about it. All of a sudden, regular Joe Schmoes living in Maine weren't exactly sure if they owned the land that their house was on. That freaked out banks in the real estate industry. The state, well, they threw a bit of a fit.
Jim Longley was the governor, known widely and not so fondly as Crazy Jim.
Jim Longley was one of those angry populist governors who was always talking about how he was a businessman.
He went on television like four nights in a row, commending the people of Maine for not resorting to violence. He said, please, there's no reason for violence here. Do not become violent. Well, the sporting goods stores started getting, you know, bought out of ammunition. I started getting death threats. I bought a gun, actually, and carried it. I mean, things were getting very tense.
But it was also a sign that the tribes were winning. This was their moment. The state of Maine was ready to negotiate. The entire fate of Maine's economy rested on getting this deal settled, and settled fast. The state sends in John Patterson, deputy attorney general at the time. He was a tall, skinny guy, sideburns, 70s hair. This was a big deal for a young lawyer. John also recalls Governor Longley's flair for drama.
There's no question that he was very aggressive in his attitude towards the claim.
Fear-mongering, in a way.
Well, I don't know that I'd use those words, but I'd say he was very aggressive, yeah.
Here's how the negotiations went down. The talks mostly took place at the state capitol in Maine, sometimes at the White House, because any negotiation would need federal approval. Jimmy Carter was president and eager to get a deal together that worked for the tribes and for Maine. On one side, you had Tom Tureen and the tribes claiming 2/3 of Maine. And on the other side, you had the state of Maine. So tell me, what was Maine's objective in reaching an agreement with the tribes?
Well, it's a complicated question, but generally the objective was to settle it without paying any money. That evolved over time as various settlement proposals came forward from the White House.
What started out as a negotiation for a payout and some land ended up being about power. Governor Longley was adamant that Maine would not play by the same rule book as other states. He hated this idea of a nation within a nation. And so the negotiations started to pose questions like, who can enforce the laws on the reservations? The tribe or the state? Should the tribes be taxed? Who gets to regulate fishing and hunting? When it became clear that the tribes might expand their land base, Maine didn't want to relinquish control.
Since we were familiar with, generally, with how Indians were treated in the western states, and were aware that in general, tribes were not subject to any state laws, and the concern was that if they were going to get a substantial land base, what would it mean if you took ultimately 300,000 acres of land, which had been just been ordinary land subject to all state laws, and all of a sudden made it different by not having it subject to state laws.
The tribes and Tom Terene suspected that this was less about Maine losing control and more about Governor Longley keeping it.
Purely political. Purely political. That Jim Longley realized that he could be elected governor for life by campaigning against no nation within a nation, creating fear. It was of no value to the state, of no practical value. It was of political value to Jim Longley and to the other leaders at the time.
The negotiations might have gone on for years and years or more, except for one thing. A clock was ticking. Because of the special status of tribes, any deal between the state of Maine and the tribal nations needed to be approved by the federal government, aka Jimmy Carter, the president at the time. But this is 1980, re-election year. Things weren't looking good for Carter against his opponent, Ronald Reagan. And one thing was for certain, Reagan was not a tribal sympathizer. In fact, he even said he would veto the deal if it came across his table. Everything was at risk of being lost. Years of negotiations, all for naught, if they didn't settle on something before Reagan won. Tom says that time crunch was a nightmare.
Did the members of the negotiating committee appreciate that there were compromises? And of course they did. I mean, we spent endless hours in this. Did everybody understand everything? Probably not. It was complex.
The 1980 Maine Indian Claims Settlement Act passed through Congress and was signed by Jimmy Carter 1 month before the election that, as we know, he lost. The tribes got $81.5 million and the right to purchase 300,000 acres of land. And in exchange, they had to give up their claim to two-thirds of the state of Maine and any money that would have been owed to them. Remember, Maine looted their trust fund and profited off their lands. The tribes are still technically sovereign. They can run their own governments, solve conflicts on the reservation. They got hunting and fishing rights, but they were once again under the thumb of Maine. And now it was in writing. And more importantly, they had agreed that when and if Congress passed any new federal laws that would benefit tribes across the nation, those new laws would not apply to the tribes in Maine.
The thing that bothered me the most about the settlement was that federal laws, new ones, didn't automatically apply. And it was going to be a constant struggle. Was it worth getting everything else? Unquestionably. Because of the high level of uncertainty, we hated it. But it was worth making that compromise to get the settlement for everything else. We didn't win everything, and we got the critical things so that the tribes ensured survival.
Years later, after much of the money had been spent, investments made good and bad, there would be a lot of conspiracies about what happened during the negotiations. Accusations of backroom dealings or withholding details. And as time went on, the tribes started to feel the loss of that power. They felt unprotected by the state and unsure of their future. The Passamaquoddy negotiator we talked to, Wayne Newell, still wonders if they made the right choice.
Maybe it was a mistake, but look at everything that forced us into that corner and said, okay, we'll take what we can get.
At the time, everyone involved felt like they had really accomplished something. When I interviewed John Patterson, the negotiator for the state, one thing stood out in his home office. It was a large black and white framed photo from 1980.
So I thought you'd like to see the picture on the wall here, which I've had for several years.
Oh, would you actually describe that for me?
Yeah, that's outside the west wing of the White House in October of 1980, and it was the entire tribal negotiating team and their attorneys.
Who's the gentleman in the center?
That's Tom Terene.
We can note that everyone is smiling in this picture.
Everybody was very happy with the deal. Very happy.
Coming up later in the series, how that happy moment turned sour. The state would use their new powers to take away something that the tribes valued more than money, their way of life. And in the next episode, the one tribe in Maine that didn't sign on to the settlement, the Mi'kmaqs, and how they decided to take a more difficult road to sovereignty. Sovereign is a production of the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies at the Maine College of Art. This episode was produced and written by me, Sanam Skelly. Our other producers are Sarah Esikoff, Serena Snyder, and Matthew Brown. Our editor is Robert Smith. Molly and Dana consulted on this project. This episode was mixed by Merritt Jacob. Our show art is by Haley Emmons. Isaac Kestenbaum is the director of Salt. Special thanks to reporter Colin Woodard. I highly recommend reading his series Unsettled, written for the Portland Press Herald. I'd also like to thank Passamaquoddy historian Donald Soktoma for walking me through the Tribal Museum and for taking me back in time. And thanks to Tim Woodcock for explaining all the legalese of the deal. I'm Sanam Skelly.
Isaac Kestenbaum here. I'm the director of SALT, and I just wanted to say that if you liked what you heard today and you want to make a podcast yourself, well, check out SALT. We offer graduate-level certificates in audio and podcasting, as well as short film, through a 15-week immersive semester up here in Maine. We also have a lot of online workshops that we offer year-round. So to learn more about any of this, just check out meca.edu/SALT. That's meca.edu/SALT. Also, I just want to say a very special thanks to Carly Peruccio for all the work that she did to help put this episode together. And another very special thanks to Merritt Jacob, because in addition to mixing this episode, he also did all the music that you heard.
This podcast was brought to you by Bangor Savings Bank. Bangor Savings Bank celebrates New England and its many locales. It's where we live, love, grow, and build. With the personal service and the heart of a local bank, but the resources and technology of a larger bank, Bangor Savings Bank fits the needs of your local community. Bangor Savings Bank. Local matters. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender.